AIDS brings a response from the government.
AIDS, the disease which claims life.
Welcome to AIDS Lost Voices with me, William Hampson. In this series, we journey through the decades to explore how Britain reported on the AIDS pandemic. We'll delve into the newspaper archives from the 80s, 90s and noughties, unearthing individual stories that reveal the human experiences behind the headlines. Join me as we seek to understand the complexities of a crisis that reshaped lives and challenged societal perceptions. Ready? Let's go. Dividing a person's life into separate episodes presents a unique challenge in podcasting, particularly when the subject's journey morphs from a tale of scientific breakthrough to the, as we'll learn in this episode, murky waters of international controversy, if not embarrassment. In the case of David Carr, whose tragic demise at the age of 25 in August 1959 raised significant questions among the doctors treating him, they, later with the emergence of HIV/AIDS in the 1980s, added a complex layer to his story. Because his doctors, along with UK researchers, analysing tissue samples taken at the time of his death in 1959, declared in a Lancet paper in 1990 that David Carr had indeed been HIV positive, thus recontextualising his life and death whilst marking him as the world's first known AIDS case. As the investigation into his medical history unfolded, it became clear that, much like life itself, narratives exist in multifaceted layers, revealing that there are indeed two sides to every story, and David Carr is no exception. Although in this instance, David Carr had no say in how his life story was written and indeed shared with the world. We ended the previous episode where, on the 24th of March 1995, the Independent newspaper ran the front page headline, "World's first AIDS case was false," with the strapline, "Tissue from man who died in 1959 may have been swapped with patient who died 21 years later." In addition to this front page story, there is a two-page spread on pages 2 and 3 which really share the same insight, although the spread appears under the headline, "How Scientists Discovered False Evidence on the World's First AIDS Victim," where the Independent reports. David Carr's medical condition was a mystery throughout his five-month stay at Manchester's Royal Infirmary. He remained a mystery long after his death on the 31st of August 1959. The 25-year-old apprentice printer was in reasonably good general health until he developed breathlessness, night sweats, tiredness, and loss of weight in December 1958. From then on, his health deteriorated radically and dramatically. Scaly, brownish lesions had appeared on his skin, he developed a fever and a painful anal ulcer, appeared in February 1959, followed by another ulcer between his nostrils and upper lip. Quote, "He was wasted, febrile and ill," his doctors wrote. Mr. Carr was admitted to the Royal Infirmary on the 8th of April, but nothing the doctors did seemed to help him. The breathlessness and wasting became severe, and he died officially of pneumonia caused by pneumocystis carinii, an opportunist infection that takes advantage of a weakened immune system, and cytomegalic inclusion disease, a viral infection causing the cells of the lungs to become enlarged and damaged. The case of David Carr was so unusual that the two doctors and the hospital pathologist studying him decided to describe it to the medical community by writing a detailed description in The Lancet. It was published on the 29th of October 1960. Trevor Stretton, medical registrar, John Leonard, senior registrar, and George Williams, the pathologist who carried out the autopsy on Mr. Carr, had no idea what was responsible for their patient's fatal fall into ill health. Judging by the complete lack of response to their Lancet paper, neither did anyone else. David Carr remained a medical enigma until the early 1980s. Sorry to just interrupt here, but how can it be a medical enigma when, the previous episode, the newspapers were reporting that the official documented cause of death of David Carr was Wegener's granulomatosis, this rare condition. And also as well, we've just heard in this article, they're saying that his cause of death was a form of pneumonia, pneumocystis carinii, which takes advantage of a weakened immune system. Yes, it was commonly seen in AIDS patients, but you didn't have to have AIDS to die of pneumocystis carinii. As the article here states, you just had to have a condition that severely weakened your immune system. So it's not a medical enigma. Don't know if this is a newspaper or whether this is coming from the doctors. Anyhow, David Carr remained a medical enigma until the early 1980s, when it dawned on the three doctors that their patient had symptoms similar to those beginning to appear in medical literature due to a mysterious new illness, AIDS. In 1983, they wrote to The Lancet posing the question, did our patient have AIDS? They pointed out that the man, who was not then named, had been in the Navy between 1955 and 1957, when they supposed he had travelled abroad. Quote, "He was not married and we know nothing of his sexual orientation," the doctors wrote. The implication was that the man could have been homosexual. He wasn't, but could have been homosexual and might have picked up the AIDS virus whilst overseas. AIDS researchers took a keen interest in the case, and this encouraged Dr. Williams, the pathologist, to locate the tissue samples he took in 1959 from the body. Although it was standard practice to store such samples, the unusual nature of death led Dr. Williams to take more tissue samples than usual. He sliced small portions of tissue from just about every organ in Mr. Carr's body. Dr. Williams said he preserved more than 40 samples and embedded them in paraffin blocks. Each set of tissues was given a unique number, which could be used to cross-reference the sample with the post-mortem examination records of each case in question. Dr. Williams said there are thousands of stored tissue samples in the pathology department of Manchester University. Quote, "When I was looking for the tissue for this patient, I came across blocks from patients just after the last war," he said. Dr. Williams said he located the tissue samples taken from Mr. Carr in 1987. Unfortunately, there was no test for HIV at the time that was sophisticated enough to use in such dried-out material. And the newspaper article just highlights in brackets, the HIV antibody test, which came out around 1985, was designed to work primarily on blood serum. Then, towards the end of the 1980s, scientists had developed a new technique for amplifying minute quantities of DNA, the genetic blueprint, from all manner of tissue fragments. The polymerase chain reaction, PCR, test has revolutionised forensic science and was now about to be employed on the mortal remains of David Carr. Dr. Williams sent some samples to Gerald Corbett in the hospital's virology unit. Together with his research assistant Andrew Bailey, Dr. Corbett applied the PCR test to the tissue and had a positive result. They found that HIV had infiltrated the DNA. Dr. Corbett, however, wanted to be absolutely sure that this was not a, quote, "false positive," end quote, result. He was well aware that the PCR test was so sensitive that it could easily amplify any stray molecules of HIV that may contaminate the samples, so he asked Dr. Williams to send him some more tissue, but this time in a proper blind trial. Dr. Williams therefore sent Dr. Corbett 12 tissue samples in separate tubes. 6 came from David Carr and 6 from a man of a similar age who had died in a traffic accident in the same year. Neither Dr. Corbett nor Mr. Bailey knew which sample came from which patient because only Dr. Williams had access to the code describing what each tube contained. Dr. Williams said he kept the code in a locked drawer and no one but himself had seen it. Quote, "When I say no one, I mean no one," he told The Independent. The blind experiment went ahead. Mr. Bailey, who did much of the bench work, performed the PCR test on each of the 12 tissue samples. He and Dr. Corbett went to extraordinary lengths to avoid contamination because they knew how sensitive the PCR test can be. The work was done in a laboratory where, as far as they know, researchers had never handled HIV. As an added precaution, half a dozen different rooms were used for each stage of the experiment, and the scientists wore disposable gloves, gowns, and hats while working with the samples in an air-filtered hood. They had even asked Dr. Williams to slice sections of the stored tissue blocks using different laboratory knives. Dr. Williams said he also washed the knives in alcohol to make absolutely sure there was no cross-contamination. Mr. Bailey repeated the PCR experiment twice and got the same results each time. 4 of the tissues were positive for HIV, 8 were negative. It was left to Dr. Corbett to phone over the results to Dr. Williams, who had the code to hand. Dr. Corbett read the results through, quote, "one by one," end quote, and was told that the 4 positives all came from David Carr. Kidney, bone marrow, spleen and throat tissue all had HIV present. Tissue from Carr's brain and liver were negative, as were all the tissue samples from the, quote, "negative control," end quote. The results surprised Dr. Corbett because they were better than ever expected. Quote, "An occasional false positive wouldn't come as any great surprise, so to get the correlation of the sort we got did surprise me," he said. With Mr. Bailey and Dr. Williams, he quickly submitted the results of the research to The Lancet, which published them as the short letter on the 7th of July 1990. The resulting international publicity was huge. The three researchers, along with Dr. Stretton and Dr. Leonard, were feted on both sides of the Atlantic. The New York Times proclaimed, quote, "Puzzle of sailor's death solved after 31 years. The answer is AIDS," end quote. Dr. Williams remembers well the day when the news story broke. He was on a fishing holiday in Scotland, driving across Lonely Moorland at about 7:45 a.m, listening to Radio 4's Today programme. He heard the late Brian Redhead talking about a young pathologist in Manchester who had performed an autopsy in 1959. Quote, "It was almost as if someone was speaking to me," Dr. Williams recalls. News of the, quote, 1959 sailor, end quote, people had not realised then that David Carr, as a national serviceman, was not a professional seaman, once again stirred intense interest in the United States. In particular, it intrigued a committee of scientists set up to investigate allegations in Rolling Stone magazine that AIDS could have come about as a result of a mass polio vaccination campaign in the Belgian Congo between 1957 and 1960. In March 1992, Rolling Stone had published an article written by the journalist Tom Curtis, suggesting that the AIDS virus might have been transmitted inadvertently from monkeys to humans because monkey cells were used to make the polio vaccine, and it was understood that the simian immunodeficiency virus, SIV, was the most probable ancestor of HIV. The theory that a polio vaccine was the route for SIV to enter the human population was intriguing, yet the only evidence to support it was circumstantial. In December 1993, Rolling Stone had to print a, quote, clarification, end quote, of its earlier story at the behest of the Wistar Institute in Philadelphia, which had made the Congo vaccine, and the scientist responsible for developing it, Hilary Kaprowski. The central reason for the apologetic statement was that the committee of scientists had taken the case of the Manchester seaman into account in its reviewing of Rolling Stone's theory. The scientists, appointed by the Wistar Institute, said in their report, quote, "The Manchester man had returned to England by the first half of 1957, before the Congo trial was begun. Therefore, it can be stated with almost complete certainty that the large polio vaccine trial begun in 1957 in Congo was not the origin of AIDS," end quote. A Wistar Institute press statement in October 1992 reiterated the importance of the 1959 case, quote, "The most conclusive evidence refuting the origin of the AIDS theory involves the earliest documented case of HIV-1 infection, a merchant marine, psych, who was symptomatic in 1958 and died of AIDS in 1959 in Manchester, England." Quote, "While this man travelled abroad to Northern Africa beginning in 1955, he had returned to England by the first half of 1957 before the Congo trial was begun," end quote. However, it was the tenacity of one member of this committee, David Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Centre in New York City and professor of medicine and microbiology at New York University School of Medicine, that has now cast grave doubts over the scientific validity of the case of the Manchester sailor. Professor Ho contacted the Manchester researchers in 1992 to learn more about the man who had subsequently been named in the Sunday Express. Professor Ho asked for samples to perform PCR tests himself. Manchester University's Gerald Corbett said that after the Lancet letter of 1990, he and Andrew Bailey had tried to sequence the genetic code of HIV, but had only limited success. They had managed to get a partial DNA sequence, enough to know it was HIV-1 and not the other major type of AIDS virus, HIV-2, but had recognised their limitations. Quote, "To be perfectly truthful, we are a hospital diagnostic laboratory and we were beginning to get out of our depth," Dr. Corbett said. Professor Ho's lab, however, was a specialist AIDS centre and was accustomed to performing difficult PCR tests and rapid genetic sequencing. Soon after being sent processed DNA from kidney tissue, which had been left over from the 1990 experiment, Professor Ho was able to isolate the entire sequence of HIV, quote, "with ease," end quote. He did this in 1993 and now had the complete virus, from one end of its genetic code to the other. He also found that the genetic sequence was identical to the partial sequence of Corbett and Bailey, scientific confirmation that it was the same virus isolated earlier by the two Manchester virologists. The sequence, however, began to puzzle Professor Ho, following a discussion he had with Gerald Myers, director of the HIV sequence database at the US's Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico, and a world authority on the genetics of the virus. Quote, Jerry told us his concerns about the possibility that it was a contaminant. All the calculations and analyses Jerry did suggest that it could be a contaminant. The virus did not make any sense based on everything he has known about them, Professor Ho said. Dr. Myers was well aware from nearly a decade's work on the AIDS virus that it is one of the fastest evolving life forms. Its speed of change is dramatic. He estimated the strains of HIV circulated in the world alter their DNA sequence by about 1% per year. This would mean the 1959 virus, which presumably must have infected cars years earlier, should have differed from 1990 strains by 30% or more. The essential problem Dr. Myers had identified is that the virus supposedly dating back to 1959 was, to all intents and purposes, identical to strains of HIV circulating in North America and Europe in 1990. Quote, "You couldn't distinguish it from a 1990 virus," Professor Ho said. Dr. Myers dismissed the 1959 virus as an aberration. Further evidence suggested that if this was a 1990 contaminant, it was no ordinary contaminant. For a start, Dr. Ho had identified, quote, quasi-species, end quote, of HIV in the initial samples sent from Manchester. This means the virus he had detected was present as swarms of slightly different forms, indicating it was a genuine HIV infection with multiple copies of actively replicating virus. It could not be a one-off contaminant. Secondly, any accidental PCR contamination would be unlikely to result in an entire virus ending up in experimental material. Professor Ho was able to sequence the complete virus, which could only mean one of two things. Either a complete clone of HIV had somehow got into the tissue sample, or tissue was genuinely infected with the virus. The former is most unlikely, he said, because few laboratories use HIV clones and Dr. Corbett's lab is not one of them. And in any case, all sequences of such clones are known, and the sequence he determined was not from any known HIV clone in the world. This left the New York scientists with an uncomfortable conclusion. Quote, "Given what we've done now in the past few months, we would think the initial sequence was incorrect or there's been a sample mix-up. We even discussed wild ideas that someone intentionally provided us with a sample that just came from a contemporary AIDS patient," Professor Ho said. In summary, he concluded that the initial sample of genetic material from kidney tissue sent from Manchester was genuinely infected with HIV, but that this virus was disturbingly similar to 1990 strains. He faxed a note to Dr. Corbett in January 1994 saying how he was, quote, "greatly troubled," end quote, by the sequence. Professor Ho was so concerned that he decided to ask the Manchester researchers for the actual tissue samples themselves rather than processed DNA supposedly derived from them to see for himself whether they contained HIV. After several months' delay, in February 1994, he received a set of 9 tissue batches from Dr. Williams and Dr. Corbett. Each was embedded in their original paraffin blocks. After an exhaustive series of tests using the most sensitive PCR tests available, however, he failed to find any evidence of HIV infection in any of the tissues, including kidney, throat, liver, heart, bone marrow, brain, and pancreas. As a final check, Professor Ho employed a sophisticated DNA test to see whether this set of tissues all came from the same person. They did. However, when he compared them against the DNA sent to him earlier, he was shocked to discover that this HIV-positive tissue was from another person. Furthermore, the size of fragments of a gene the scientists used as another check on their PCR technology indicated the two sets of samples from Manchester were from tissues of significantly different ages. The HIV-positive tissue generated large gene fragments, a clear indication it was recent tissue, whereas the second batch of HIV-negative tissue produced small fragments, showing the DNA had degraded, as it does in older tissue. Everything pointed to the positive batch coming from a 1990 AIDS patient. Oh, God, embarrassing, isn't it? The 1990 Lancet research had therefore failed the ultimate scientific test of its validity, replication by other scientists. It will now have to be retracted. The tissues of David Carr appear, after all, to have been HIV negative, and his fatal illness the result of another unexplained cause. Mr. Carr's condition remains as much a mystery today as it was in 1959. Oh, Oh, gosh. I don't even know. How did you get out of that one? Anyhow, the very next day, on the 25th of March 1995, the Manchester Evening News ran the headline, New AIDS Test on Zero Man of 1959, where they concluded the article with this following insight. Dr. Williams, the pathologist, who retired 3 years ago, has approached the Medical Protection Society, of which he is a member, for legal advice on the matter. Oh. Meanwhile, senior doctors in Manchester confirmed that further tests are to be carried out on, quote, patient zero, end quote. Oh, anyhow, the plot thickens, as on the same day, the 25th of March 1995, the Independent newspaper ran the headline, AIDS tissue taken to secret location, where they report, health officials yesterday refused to comment, quote, for security reasons, end quote, on the whereabouts of stored tissue samples from David Carr, who died in 1959 and was believed until yesterday to be the world's oldest confirmed case of AIDS. More than 40 blocks of tissue were taken from Carr at his 1959 postmortem examination by Dr. George Williams, a retired pathologist at Manchester Royal Infirmary, and stored until recently at the hospital. Dr. Williams has told The Independent that he has, quote, sequestered, end quote, the tissue samples at a secret location. He said the tissue samples at the centre of the controversy over whether David Carr was HIV positive are of, quote, considerable historical value, end quote, and he wants to keep them safe. A spokesman for the Manchester Royal Infirmary said the precise whereabouts of the tissue samples will remain confidential because of the need to keep them secure. She refused to say whether the hospital knows where the tissue is kept, whether Dr. Williams had received permission to sequester it, or on the legal position regarding who owns the tissue. David Carr's tissue is of crucial importance because Manchester University and the Royal Infirmary want to repeat tests performed by Professor David Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Centre in New York, who found that the tissue from David Carr was HIV negative. Oh, it's turning into quite the drama. But then, a few days later, on the 28th of March 1995, in a response to the Independent newspaper's coverage of the story around David Carr, a letter was published in the same newspaper from Dr. John Leonard and Dr. Trevor Stretton, the two doctors who had attended to David Carr at the Manchester Royal Infirmary. They printed the letter under the headline, Evidence Backs First AIDS Case. And the doctors asserted that they stood by David Carr's tissue testing HIV positive, where they wrote, Sir, as clinicians responsible for the care of the patient described as, quote, the world's first case of AIDS, end quote, from page article 24th of March, we wish to affirm our total confidence in the integrity of our pathologist colleague, Dr. George Williams. The suggestion that there was deliberate tampering with the scientific evidence is unworthy of your paper. Scarcely less credible is the alternative implication that tissue samples in such a sensitive and unique patient were mixed up in the laboratory. We also find it strange that Professor David Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Centre, New York, should have chosen to reveal his findings to a daily newspaper rather than in a medical or scientific journal where they could be properly evaluated by those qualified to comment. Whatever the ultimate conclusions of the virologist may be, we remain confident that our patient in 1959 did indeed suffer from the condition now known as AIDS. Your headline, quote, world's first AIDS case was false, end quote, is both misleading and unsubstantiated by the medical and virological evidence presently available. Yours faithfully, John Leonard, Hopesay, Shropshire, Trevor Stretton, Cheadle Hume, Cheshire, 25th of March, 1995. So, the doctors are standing by their results, which, I mean, who can blame them, really? It must have been a hard pill to swallow. Anyhow, it doesn't end there, as everyone involved is being approached for answers, this time the turn of Dr. Gerald Corbett, who carried out the initial tests on David Carr's tissue samples. His findings have come under renewed scrutiny following the explosive claims that the National Health Service, the NHS, suppressed the truth behind what was now dubbed the false AIDS case, where The Independent ran the headline on the 6th of April 1995, Admission of False AIDS Case Suppressed by NHS, where they reported. An admission that research showing the world's first case of AIDS, involving a Manchester man who died in 1959, was false, has been suppressed by NHS officials. Central Manchester Healthcare NHS Trust refused permission for one of its scientists, Dr. Gerald Corbett, to send a letter of retraction to The Lancet, which in 1990 published research, quote, proving, end quote, that the 1959 patient was infected with HIV. The science journal, Nature, today publishes the evidence that categorically refutes the 1990 study. A reanalysis of tissue material dating back to 1959 failed to find any evidence of HIV with the most sensitive techniques available. Scientists also found the tissue used in the 1990 study did not appear to come from the 1959 patient. After articles in The Independent on the 24th of March, where the Lancet research was shown to be false, senior representatives of the trust, which runs the Manchester Royal Infirmary, told Dr. Corbett not to submit the retraction he had prepared. Angela Anderson, a spokeswoman for the trust, yesterday denied any knowledge of Dr. Corbett's letter. Quote, I am not aware of any letter, but I can't say it doesn't exist because I don't know, she said. However, Dr. Corbett, who has since been told not to talk to the press, had previously told The Independent, quote, the results we produced in 1990 and published are clearly invalidated for whatever reasons, end quote. Asked whether he intended to publish a correction, Dr. Corbett replied, quote, indeed, I'm the first to agree with you on this. I've got a letter in draft, end quote. However, after a meeting with his trust employers, Dr. Corbett was asked again about the letter, quote, I've been put on hold for the time being. That's not my decision, he said. Dr. Corbett had also told David Ho, the New York scientist who had uncovered problems with the 1990 research, about the letter. Dr. Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center, said, quote, Corbett did say he wanted to send a retraction to The Lancet, but he never sent me a copy of that and he never said why not, end quote. At the centre of the dispute is tissue taken from the corpse of David Carr, 25, who died mysteriously in 1959, which was stored for more than 30 years. Oh man, can you imagine being the cousin or being David's fiancée, Ethel, at the time, just watching this play out in the newspapers? It's just hideous, isn't it? Anyhow, but what I'm sure we all want to know is, do they settle the disagreement between both sets of scientific findings that appear to be clearly at odds with each other? Although Dr. Ho and his team do make a compelling case. I mean, I personally am more with Dr. Ho on this one. Anyhow, on the 10th of April 1995, the Independent newspaper ran the headline, New Tests to Help Solve Dispute Over First AIDS Case, with the strapline, Home Office Experts to Analyse Tissue Samples. Yay! Where they report. Oh, I can't wait. Home Office forensic scientists are this week expected to begin tests on tissue material allegedly from the world's first case of AIDS, a Manchester man who died in 1959. The scientists have been asked to resolve a dispute over whether the tissue is from one person or two. They will use DNA fingerprinting. How do you fingerprint tissue samples? To clarify the issue. Central Manchester Healthcare NHS Trust has asked the Forensic Science Service in Wetherby, West Yorkshire, to perform the fingerprint analysis on DNA and tissue samples sent from the New York laboratories of Dr. David Ho, the scientist who has cast doubt over the authenticity of research published in The Lancet in 1990, which claimed that the 1959 patient was infected with HIV. The research by Dr. Gerald Corbett, a Manchester healthcare virologist, and Dr. George Williams, a retired pathologist from the Manchester Royal Infirmary, who supplied tissue for Dr. Corbett to analyse, claimed to have found HIV in the 1959 patient whose tissue had been stored for more than 30 years. As reported in The Independent last month, Dr. Ho, director of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center and professor of medicine and microbiology at New York University School of Medicine, found that experimental material allegedly from the 1959 patient and supplied to him by scientists from the Healthcare Trust was from two separate people. Dr. Ho also failed to find any evidence of HIV in tissue samples supplied to them last year by Dr. Williams, which were allegedly from the 1959 patient. They concluded that these two findings invalidated the 1990 Lancet research. Angela Anderson, a spokeswoman for Central Manchester Healthcare NHS Trust, said that a preliminary investigation by the Trust has shown that tissue samples held in Manchester, allegedly from the 1959 patient, are from one person. She could not say, however, whether this tissue is the same as that used as the basis of the 1990 research. The Manchester Trust has, for the moment, declined an offer by a leading AIDS researcher, Professor Robin Weiss of the Institute of Cancer Research in London, to carry out an analysis. Professor James Burney, a consultant at the Trust, said, quote, "The only way you can get a meaningful HIV analysis is if you are certain that it is the patient in question, and secondly, if there is only one patient," end quote. If there are two patients, quote, "We are then looking at a retraction in a big way," end quote. Professor Burney said the Forensic Science Service had been chosen because, quote, "They are the definitive people," end quote. And he wanted to be sure the authors of the 1990 research and Dr. Ho were happy with the competence and independence of the scientists undertaking the checks. The latest analysis of the HIV that Dr. Ho managed to extract from the first set of samples from Manchester has shown that the virus is closely related to strains circulating in Britain in the 1980s, according to Gerald Myers, director of the American HIV sequence database at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, New Mexico. Oh, I can't stop sighing. This is just one of those stories with each article. I think we've gone from the size of dismay. We're now heading towards the size of relief that somebody's now looking into this. But with the Home Office involved in retesting these samples belonging to David Carr, there is a renewed sense of hope for a conclusive resolution, particularly given that some still contest to this day the HIV status of these samples. As the anticipation for the outcome builds, Professor Moore, chairman of Central Manchester Healthcare Trust, has penned a letter to The Independent in response to one of their earlier articles, where he wrote, "Sir, your article, quote, 'Admission of False AIDS Case Suppressed by NHS,' end quote, 6th of April 1995, a follow-up to one on the 24th of March 1995 relating to the world's first ever AIDS victim, accused NHS officials of suppressing information and implies that the Central Manchester Healthcare NHS Trust tried to gag an employee, Dr. Gerald Corbett, who was involved in the case. I can assure you that neither of these statements is correct. I have spent a lifetime as an academic and I believe in academic freedom. I would not countenance any attempt to prevent a full discussion of all the issues involved in this or any other case. This trust does not gag its employees. Dr. Corbett has assured me that he has felt free to discuss his work on the 1959 AIDS victim freely, and he has done so. Yours sincerely, S.A. Moore, Chairman, Central Manchester Healthcare Trust, Manchester Royal Infirmary, Manchester, 18th of April, 1995. Oh, I can't stop sighing. Gosh, it's handbags, isn't it? Anyway, then off the back, but he's got a point. Then off the back of that letter, Dr. Gerald Corbett, the man himself, pens a letter to The Independent, which reads, "Sir, your article, quote, 'Admission of False AIDS Case Suppressed by NHS,' end quote, 6th of April 1995, relating to research into the death in May 1959, David actually died on the 31st of August 1959, of a man presumed to be the earliest known AIDS case, suggests that I had a letter retracting my laboratory's own findings, suppressed by my employer's Central Manchester Healthcare NHS Trust. In fact, although I spoke to your correspondent about preparing such a letter as my first reaction, I never reached the stage of drafting a text. Dr. David Ho of the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Centre in New York and I have collaborated openly over this investigation since July 1992. When he advised me of this most recent findings, I wrote to him suggesting a joint publication in The Lancet that might address the apparent dilemma. His findings raise a number of questions that need to be answered. Further studies are now ongoing and these results will be published when available. May I add, I have never been prevented from speaking freely on this issue. Yours faithfully, Gerald Corbett, Department of Clinical Virology, Central Manchester Healthcare NHS Trust, Manchester." And his letter was printed in The Independent on the 3rd of May 1995. Then, by the 19th of January 1996, the Home Office, having completed its testing and communicated its findings to the doctors involved, prompted widespread media coverage, particularly in The Independent newspaper, which prominently featured the headline, "Scientists admit error on first AIDS case," where they report, Claims that the world's first AIDS case was a sailor from Manchester who died in 1959 were wrong. Two of the scientists who did the original research have admitted. The scientists say the mistake arose because tissue samples from the patient probably became contaminated with a modern strain of HIV. Doubts over the validity of the claim were first revealed in The Independent last year. Subsequent tests show that David Carr, a 25-year-old who died of a mysterious illness, although Wegener's granulomatosis is not so mysterious, rare but not mysterious, illness in Manchester Royal Infirmary, was not infected with the virus, HIV. In a letter published in tomorrow's issue of The Lancet, two of the scientists, Andrew Bailey and Gerald Corbett, admit, quote, "We can find no evidence to suggest the 1959 Manchester patient carried HIV," end quote. It was another letter signed by Dr. George Williams, a pathologist at Manchester University, Mr. Corbett and Mr. Bailey, published in The Lancet in 1990, which brought worldwide attention and acclaim. It challenged the accepted view that AIDS, first reported in 1981, was a newly emerging disease. Dr. Williams, who carried out the post-mortem examination on Mr. Carr in 1959, retrieved samples of Mr. Carr's tissue, which had been in storage for more than 30 years, for detailed analysis by colleagues at the university. Dr. Williams had remembered the case because it was so unusual. Mr. Carr had suffered from infections common in AIDS patients. In 1994, however, leading American AIDS scientists questioned the validity of the research carried out by the team. They had studied the genetic makeup of the Carr virus and were astonished to find that it was identical to HIV strains circulating in the 1980s. HIV mutates very rapidly, and experts expected the Carr virus to be very different from modern strains. The American team performed more tests and later suggested that tissue samples from Carr used in the original research may have been mixed up with those of another man who died in the 1980s. This has always been strenuously denied by the Manchester scientists. In their most recent Lancet letter, Mr. Bailey and Mr. Corbett said that experiments by an independent team which would have settled this matter were inconclusive. Oh, so just right at the end there, we got a little microphone drop. I wonder what he means by inconclusive, but I suspect this next article might clear that up, because if, like me, you're a bit bewildered and wondering how on earth this was able to happen, it's worth reflecting on the inquiry that was led by experts, where their view garnered significant attention on the 3rd of December 1996, so the opposite end of the year, where The Independent ran the striking headline, "AIDS research fault is not likely to be accident, say experts," where they report, "Experts have cast serious doubt on suggestions that pure accident led to the faulty research results, which prompted a team of Manchester scientists to claim, wrongly, that the world's first AIDS patient died in 1959. Following an investigation by The Independent, which first revealed doubts about the research, the experts, who include an Oxford professor, say there is only a 3% chance that faulty tests which led to the claims arose through bad luck. In 1990, a team of scientists at Manchester University found HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, during a retrospective analysis of tissue samples from David Carr, a 25-year-old apprentice printer who died of a mysterious illness in 1959. None were found in control samples from another person who died at the same time. By none, they mean HIV. This led them to make the world-famous claim in the medical journal The Lancet that July that Mr. Carr was the, quote, "world's first confirmed case of AIDS," end quote. Based on this, a number of scientists theorised that AIDS was an ancient disease rather than a new one which had arisen in the past few decades. But the Manchester claim was subsequently exploded by The Independent, which revealed in March 1995 that American researchers had determined that the strain of HIV found in the tissues evolved too recently to have existed in 1959. In January 1996, Andrew Bailey and Gerald Corbett, two of the three scientists who submitted the paper, wrote to The Lancet to admit, quote, "We can find no evidence to suggest that the 1959 Manchester patient carried HIV," end quote. Edward Hooper, a medical researcher, and Professor William Hamilton, a geneticist at Oxford University, suggest two possible causes. The error which led to HIV being found only in Mr. Carr's samples could either have occurred before the samples were sent to the laboratory where they were analysed, or by a mistake in breaking the, quote, double-blind, end quote, coding, which prevented them knowing whether the samples came from Mr. Carr or from a control donor. Few alternative scenarios appear feasible. Contamination of samples from Mr. Carr by an HIV-infected knife would only be explicable if, quote, the knife supposedly wiped itself clean, end quote, on the control samples, they say. But Professor Hamilton said, quote, the fact that there are at least three human genotypes involved suggests it cannot have been a simple contamination, end quote. The third author, Dr. George Williams, the Manchester University pathologist who conducted the post-mortem examination on Mr. Carr, has repeatedly denied this. Quote, I'm utterly, absolutely confident of the authenticity of that material, end quote, he told The Independent last year. Oh, I mean, it still doesn't answer the question of how that tissue became to be contaminated, but I think going back to what Dr. Howard discovered earlier, and it seems to be the case here, that the HIV virus on the tissue was too modern to be from 1959, you know, with less mutation, because we've heard about how quickly the virus mutates itself. So it was a modern virus on old tissue, 30-year-old tissue. Anyhow, at this point, I realised the necessity of speaking to someone involved in the matter. My search revealed that Dr. Trevor Stretton had sadly passed away as recently as 2022, and I was unable to locate either Dr. John Leonard or Dr. George Williams. However, I did manage to find and reach out to Professor David Ho, but I was premature in reaching out to him before I'd gathered all the articles sharing how this all ended. I sent him an email, and he graciously, and I have to say, responded rapidly, where he stated, quote, I am afraid that I have nothing more to add to the case of David Carr, end quote. Oh, and can you blame him? Because, as we have just heard, this whole affair is a complete mess. And for us here in the UK, embarrassing, if not upsetting, for the surviving relatives of David Carr. The only saving grace was that both David's parents had sadly passed away by the time this story broke. It would have been horrendous to have subjected them to this circus. The stigma of HIV/AIDS at the time, alongside intrusive questions regarding their son's sexuality, whether he was gay or bisexual, would have only added to the anguish. From what we've gathered, David was neither gay nor bisexual, as he was happily engaged to a local girl called Ethel. Nevertheless, this narrative would have inflicted additional grief upon a family already mourning their loss, compounding a tragedy with unwarranted speculation and prejudice. Professor David Ho's profound insights in this case and his pioneering work since have undeniably transformed the landscape of HIV/AIDS research. His commitment to advancing the understanding of this virus has led to significant breakthroughs, particularly in the development of combination antiretroviral therapy, which effectively redefined HIV from a terminal diagnosis to a manageable chronic condition. The impact of his expertise is deeply felt, as illustrated by his willingness to engage personally in the investigation of David Carr's case. Had Professor Ho not intervened to conduct tests on the tissue samples himself, the prevailing narrative surrounding David Carr could have perpetuated inaccuracies that might have otherwise gone unchallenged. And I'm not for a second suggesting any malpractice by the UK physicians or individuals concerned, but it is noteworthy that certain experts held differing views on the matter, highlighting the complexities that can arise in medical interpretations. I guess only those involved in any form of wrongdoing, if any took place, know the truth. But the important element of this case is that the science on two occasions confirmed that David Carr was not living with HIV/AIDS and it was not the cause or a contributing factor to his death. This finding is significant not only for the clarity it offers regarding David Carr's health, but also for the broader implication it holds for understanding the circumstances surrounding his life and passing. The press widely reported that the official cause of David's death was recorded as Wegener's granulomatosis, a rare condition characterised by the inflammation of blood vessels, predominantly affecting the ears, nose, sinuses, kidneys and lungs. Symptoms aligned with those documented during David Carr's 20-week hospital stay included night sweats, weakness, fatigue, weight loss and the presence of a swollen nose. Furthermore, with a simple search on the internet, Cleveland Clinic literature notes that the condition may manifest on the skin as mottled patterns or lesions that were also found to be present on David, marked by, as we heard, brown scaly splotches. Despite parallels to symptoms associated with HIV/AIDS and those experienced by David Carr, it appears there is no basis to question the doctor's recorded cause of death of Wegener's granulomatosis. Why they felt David's death was a, quote, mystery, end quote, is perhaps beyond my intelligence, given their diagnosis aligns coherently with the evidence and observations that we heard of during David's prolonged illness and that they officially recorded upon his death. And in regards to HIV and AIDS being around in 1959, Professor Ho, in his response to me, did go on to state, quote, there were clearly cases of HIV infection in 1959, but those were localised to Africa. In fact, HIV probably entered the human population there about 100 years ago, but there is no evidence it got out of Africa until the 1970s, end quote. And between me emailing Professor Ho and his response, I did find an article in the Birmingham Post on the 5th of February 1998 where they ran the headline, Man Who Gave the World AIDS in 1959. Oh, before we hear the article, it is vital to recognise that headlines suggesting the blame for HIV rests solely with one individual can be misleading and reductive. And it's just fucking plain stupid, if you ask me. Anyway, back to the script. Oh, bleep that out. The notion that one person can be definitively identified as responsible for such a widespread epidemic is not only improbable but undermines the collective responsibility necessary for education, prevention and support. So, the article I mentioned goes on to state, researchers say they have traced the very first case of HIV infection to a man living in what was then the Belgian Congo in 1959. They say their finding shows the human immunodeficiency virus that causes AIDS first showed up in people 10 to 20 years earlier than previously estimated. The man was a Bantu living in Leopoldville, now Kinshasa, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Dr. David Ho and his colleagues at the Aaron Diamond AIDS Research Center in New York said, a sample of his blood produced HIV that looks like an ancestor of several subtypes of HIV now found around the world. It suggests that HIV, quote, evolved from a single introduction into the Africa population in a time frame not long before 1959, they said. The ancestral HIV-1 must have existed before 1959, probably only a few years before 1959, end quote. Mr. Tofu Zhu, who worked on the study, told the 5th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunist Infections. HIV probably originated in the late 1940s or early 1950s, quote, a decade or two earlier than previous estimates of the introduction of HIV-1 into the human population, end quote. The fate of the 1959 victim is unknown. Using genetic dating methods, Dr. Ho's team determined the virus could not have existed for many years before 1959. Many scientists think the virus spread to people through infected ape or monkey meat. And we have to remember this article was from 1998, so the advances in science and understanding may have changed. An only child, David Carr was survived by his parents Agnes, who sadly passed away on the 21st of April 1965, aged 54. His father, Herbert David Carr, placed the following notice in the Manchester Evening News on the 6th anniversary of his son's death in the same year of the loss of his wife Agnes. Cherished memories of David, my beloved son. Called to higher life, August 31st, 1959. Also, Agnes, my beloved wife. Called to higher life, April the 21st, 1965. Memories are something no one can steal. Losing you is a heartache no one can heal. The tears in my eyes I still wipe away, but in my heart you will always remain. So sadly missed, Dave. You can check out and read all the newspaper articles mentioned in this episode, along with extra snippets of information, on the Extra Tea blog. You can find the link in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to like, share and subscribe. Until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at The Lost Boys of Soho.